And you know, I'm never harassed. I've gotten one anti-Semitic tweet ever. They don't give me any love.
30% of that harassment comes from me, but yeah. That's totally different.
We prefer it in person for you.
Hello, Jews and others who dwell with us in the grand sukkah of life. This is Unorthodox, a weekly podcast from Tablet Magazine. I'm Mark Oppenheimer, joined as ever by Deputy Editor Stephanie Butnick.
Hello.
Hello. And by Senior Writer Liel Leibowitz.
Mark, you're a bad hombre. Stephanie, you're a nasty woman. This podcast is rigged.
It's just like in 2000 when Al Gore's podcast was rigged.
It's exactly the same thing.
So normally,
Al Gore probably has a podcast.
It's called Hanging Chad.
Is it really?
No.
That was good, though. That was totally what it would
be
called.
I was in middle school for that.
I'm about to make a man, bear, pig joke, but like probably 40% of our audience would get it. So.
And the other 45%
nasty.
Wouldn't, and the rest would vote for Gary Johnson.
That's true.
Mic drop. I actually am going to let you guys guess what the two most important things that happened to me were in the past week.
Okay, well,
Sukkos and...
Sukkos ain't even close. Sukkos ain't that... top 10.
You're wearing your black t-shirt to show us your David Duchovny. And also in an early Halloween, you know, surprise, also you have a cast on your hand.
I have a cast on my hand. So the cast is number two. And number one, I'll just be honest, I finally went to Canuga.
Let's just get that out there.
Say it for the last time. Canuga.
Canuga.
How was it? Was it everything you ever
Canuga
hoped for?
Canuga is this beautiful 1,400-acre Episcopal Church Conference Center in Hendersonville, North Carolina.
And as soon as he landed, by the way, life went from black and white to color. It's basically the Wizard of Oz. He made a courageous lion.
Little birds tweeted by. And
note to our producer, play Somewhere Over the Rainbow as Mark Stock.
It must have been really pretty this time of
year. It was beautiful. It looks like New England. I mean, it's in the Blue Ridge Mountains. It's about 20 minutes from Asheville. And it was gorgeous. And I spent 3 days talking and lecturing, I shouldn't say at, but with 80 exceedingly bright, curious Episcopal pastors. What?
Bright curious.
Episcopal pastors and lay people and some Presbyterians and just asking questions about the golden rule in politics. It was really quite lovely. You know what it was? It was like communion for the soul, in which there's actually literal communion. I actually had to stay seated when they're all going up for...
Did you go like this with your arms?
Are you supposed to do that?
Well, one time I went to Mass in college and I couldn't avoid going up. You can go up for the prayer, but you can't take communion. So you put your arms... I'm trying to do it right now. You cross your arms.
Yeah, that's
on your
what
shoulders.
You do if you're in sin.
Like,
if you're not
Mighty Morphin Power Ranger.
If you're Catholic, you don't. You do that if you've sinned lately and you're not confessed. You're not supposed to take communion. That's what you did.
They told me to do that. They're like, if you can get the blessing, but you can't take communion.
And you took their Catholic blessing?
I took any blessing I could get.
What do you mean you sort of happened to walk into a Catholic mass?
She experimented in college with
different blessings. I wrote a column for the newspaper about the different religious services on campus.
Stephanie's idea of like wilding out in college. And one time
I was like, this is my rebelling.
So number one was I went to Canuga. What's number two?
I have a big
cast on my arm. And we're going to send a photo of this out in the newsletter.
Of course. The dying dog storyline played out its usefulness, sympathy-wise, and now we have physical injury.
JJ is still dying at home, alas, but so is my little pinky on my left hand.
It's your pinky.
How?
And they have to do two fingers?
How squeamish are you about hearing? Do you want to hear what happened?
No.
You are now digitally enhanced.
I am.
I want to hear what happened.
I really want to hear what happened.
Okay, so Stephanie, you can plug your ears. I'm going to tell you what happened. So I'm running up the stairs like the sprightly 42-year-old I am, literally with my hands out in front of me on the stairs in front of me to get up there to get sheets, to put them on the guest bed because the in-laws are coming.
Oh, my God.
And I get to the top of the stairs. I trip, fly forward, and there's a corner of a wall. So picture, you know, a right angle. And four of my fingers go to one side of the corner, and my pinky splays onto the other. And I keep going forward, throwing my pinky back at an angle. So – I look at it. I'm in shock. It's numb for a moment before the wave of pain crashes over me.
I hate that moment.
And I think this has to be a broken finger. So I walk downstairs very calmly, calling in front of me, Sid, I broke my finger. I'm going to need to go to the hospital. Now, Sid happens to think that I have no threshold for pain and that I'm a hypochondriac, both of which are true. So she's been through my fears of testicular cancer, pneumonia, bronchitis, That one was looked at too. None of which ever pans out. So I'm walking downstairs and I know she's thinking, you didn't break your finger. And I walk in and she turns to face me, her eyes literally rolling back in her head, ready to say, you did not break your finger. And then she looks at it and turns green and says,
it's like going a different direction.
It's literally going a different direction and says, oh, oh. And then she says, let's call Liam to take you to the hospital. Liam's our friend. And she goes into like, you know, because we have four kids sleeping upstairs. So Liam takes me to the hospital. I go 3 hours later. I have the splint.
I'm sorry, you couldn't drive yourself?
I wasn't thinking I was going to drive myself. Uber was involved for the trip back. Anyway, God bless Uber. God bless Liam. I'm all right. But my you know, there may be surgery required.
So how long after that did you get on a train to come down here?
About 6 hours. Wow. About so the point being,
that's how much he loves
you. My commitment to this podcast is 6 hours later, I'm on a train to
Mark
come to
Oppenheimer
New York.
Died for your sins.
That's right. And of course, the third most important thing is Shmini Atzeret is upon us. So could somebody at last tell me what Shmini Atzeret is as a holiday? I mean, it's the day, it's the last day of Sukkot, right? But that's what true. Is it? Does it mean anything in Hebrew?
The first rule of Shmini Atzeret is
we don't talk about it.
The three of us work at a Jewish magazine. None of us knows what it means or what it is.
Well, it's just so boring to explain.
Okay.
Explain
it's
it.
Just so like...
You can't give us the 20-second praises?
Well, my understanding is, I remember I wrote the kind of explainer holiday for a tablet. It's sort of like, you know, it's the eighth day of the holiday. It's kind of the thing that you do when like all the holiday like ends and you're about to like shift into Simchas Torah. There's like one catch-all. Sort of like just to make sure you got all the mitzvahs right. It's, you know, supremely
well
technical.
Happy Shmini Atzeret to all. Happy Shmini Atzeret. All right.
Guess nothing on Hoshana Rabbah.
Oh, seriously, yeah.
Hoshana Rabbah. All right. Friends, a little news of the Jews. 250 woman rabbis, that's one word, woman rabbis, signed a letter opposing Donald J. Trump I for president. It was.
They're all fives.
He's like, they let women be rabbis?
Who would ever want to ordain them?
According to the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, about 20 protesters demonstrated last week outside the Inquiring Minds Bookstore Cafe in Saugerties in upstate New York because the owner hung a banner that superimposed the word Trump over a Nazi flag. He's against Trump, which is why he was calling him a Nazi. Some demonstrators held Trump signs. Others were counter-demonstrators who supported Hillary Clinton. And weirdly, the Anti-Defamation League's regional director, Evan Bernstein, attacked the banner as well, saying that using the symbol of Nazism to make a political point is highly inappropriate and repugnant.
And the Nazis demonstrating right. were like, please, we had ideals. We believed in something.
But isn't that weird that the Anti-Defamation League is like, no, don't call Trump a Nazi. We're going to, I mean, I guess he wants to save that word for like people who actually want to throw us in the
Nazis.
Gas chambers.
I think the problem is we throw around like Nazi. Like, think about it. Like, we call everyone a Nazi who just like disagrees with us at this point. And obviously Trump, there's like some real legit comparisons. But this idea that like you can just like put a swastika over the media sign at a press, like at a Trump rally. It's like these symbols almost are losing their meaning because we're just projecting them everywhere. And I think that's the ADL stance.
At the Desert Trip Music Festival in Palm Springs, California, jokingly called Old Acela because it's where people like Roger Waters go to.
Old Cella.
Old Acela.
Old Cella.
not Coachella, but Old Cella. Former Pink Floyd dude Roger Waters got all political.
Speaking of neo-Nazis.
He urged the audience. So the ADL is going to come after you, Liel, because you
stop
called Roger Waters.
Nazis.
Stop calling people Nazis.
Okay.
He got all political. He urged the audience to vote Hillary, and he urged Israel to end the occupation.
The person who couldn't even get along with the three other members of Pink Floyd is
like
telling
the chillest
Israel,
people
to
ever.
Get along with the Palestinians or blowing them up. It's like, you know what? Call Gilmore. Be like, first we make peace, right? Break down this wall. Then worry about our wall.
When Pink Floyd can get a reunion show together.
Yeah, that's right. When I listen to you. And by the way, the Jew on stage that really likes Israel and wrote a great song about it. Yeah, that Jew just won the Nobel Prize, bitch.
But speaking of which, in News of the Jews, it's unclear if he knows that he won the Nobel Prize because they can't find him anywhere.
They can't reach him.
They can't reach him. He's in lockdown.
Literally DGAF.
He's actually at the Tablet Studios right now. He's actually
Bobby's
upstairs.
On the pavement mixing up the medicine.
He's upstairs copy editing the next print issue, which you can get by texting
tablet to 66866. It's going to be a good one.
All right. An ultra-Orthodox website wrote about Israeli Uber model. She's more than a supermodel. She's an Uber model. Bar Rafaeli visiting B'nai Brak, but they ethnically cleansed her line of work in their article. Presumably out of opposition to the modeling profession, the site Shabbat Square wrote that, quote, businesswoman Bar Rafaeli visited B'nai Brak. I like the euphemism businesswoman for everything.
You're missing the bigger story, which is they pixelated her image.
Her.
You literally couldn't see her at all.
At all.
She was Blur Rafaeli.
Look, I love the idea that they're finally like, she is a businesswoman. She's, you know, hugely successful and has transcended past modeling. And so I
really?
Like,
what's her business?
She's not a businesswoman.
She's a businesswoman. So I love the idea that they're calling, like, that they're not being like model or like, swimsuit model Bar Rafaeli.
Mother of one, Bar Rafaeli.
They're doing it for like literally all the wrong reasons.
And if there was a Haredi Donald Trump, he would grab her by the pixel. That's pretty
good. We're like on fire today. Thank I'm really proud of you.
All right, the two most important stories of the week. Should I do the not safe for work one first or the safe for work one?
Safe for work.
Safe for work, the University of Maryland, which has boatloads of Jews, they want to make it easier for their Ortho Jews to attend home football games. So the university is going to allow the students, instead of bringing those scannable tickets that force an electronic scanner to violate the Sabbath, they're going to give them wristbands that they can put around their wrists and wear, because that makes it Shomer Shabbos. They don't have to carry them. They can wear them, and that will get them into the game. Now, of course, the solution is still not perfect, because if they have to look up at replays at the Jumbotron, for some Jewish students, that will looking at the screen alone will violate the
Sabbath.
That
has been solved, too. There will be a stage built at eye level on which will be people actually reenacting. I just love these workarounds, you know, these halachic workarounds. It's like, you know what the problem is with going to a football game on Shabbat? It's that scannable ticket.
It's the turnstile.
Get over the turnstile, and literally you're totally within both the spirit and the letter of the law.
I have an idea. There's actually an easier solution for this, which is just make it free for Orthodox. Just no ticket needed. And then everyone would be putting on yarmulkes and tzitzis, and they just all walk in, and
you
have
a
super...
The games should just be free because these are student athletes playing. And we're profiting on that. Look, as a former As a former Division I athlete.
The only one in this room.
I think it's just, you know, like we're profiting off the backs of these kids who are not, I don't know.
I agree with you.
Look, the Duke fencing team brought in so much money, like so much revenue that I can really, really speak confidently on this.
All these endorsements.
At the school, it was like pretty much the biggest sport that anyone cared about.
What did they charge to get in to watch you fence?
Well, we had the Duke meet. It was free.
Now we have the not safe for work best story of the week, which is Jewish only in that it involves...
A Jew.
Oh, she's Jewish. Well, that's right, Ivanka's Jewish.
A Jewess, okay. If you will.
All right. If you have little children, if you'd not look at the Jumbotron, maybe you should also not listen to this story. Let's put it that way. Ivanka Trump, of course, reacted to the lewd comments from the Access Hollywood tape by saying that she was shocked. She said, that's not language consistent with any conversation I've ever had with my father or any conversation I've overheard. This led Jonah Peretti, who's the CEO and founder of BuzzFeed, the website, to just kind of tell his website for a news story that he begs to differ. So he wrote out, surprised Ivanka would be shocked by lewd language. I met her once and she casually said, I've never seen a mulatto cock, but I'd like to.
This election cycle is amazing. It's like a gift that keeps on giving. Now a news story. Like serious
BuzzFeed
newspapers.
Had to do a blog post like based on their on their CEO's tweet.
News outlets are writing the phrase mulatto cock.
Right.
In their reporting, and there is nothing anyone could do about it. Wolf Blitzer will say mulatto cock on air.
Well, in his whatever the opposite of defense is, Wolf Blitzer played that tape so many times on CNN that day. My mom texted me and was like, Wolf Blitzer is having like the best day of his life.
I just want to say, what's especially great about this is actually Jonah Peretti has just been waiting for years to tell this story about the time Ivanka Trump talked about mulatto cocks, because it's actually not really related to Donald Trump at all. Like the connection in his mind, the news peg is she pretended to be shocked, but she couldn't be shocked because 12 years ago she said mulatto cock.
And all I asked her was, how's your dinner?
Our Gentile of the Week this week is Sourab Amari. He's an editorial writer for The Wall Street Journal. He lives in London, and he is the author of The New Philistines, How Identity Politics Disfigure the Arts, which has just been published. He's been with The Wall Street Journal since 2012, and we are happy to have him on the line. Hi, Sourab.
Hey, guys.
So the new book, The New Philistines, How Identity Politics Disfigure the Arts. How do identity politics disfigure the arts, Sourab?
Yeah, well, you know, I've been an art enthusiast for years, and especially since I've been in London, it's a great city for the arts. So I've just been immersing myself in this world, and I've just been going to too many, from dance performances to performance art to installations to video to theater to film, you name it, where I can't find really any trace of beauty or truth, which are sort of the eternal aspirations of art to my mind and historically in any of it. And so the only justification for all this inept art is that it reaffirms certain identitarian categories or grievances. You know,
all right,
so here's
so
a bunch
us,
of...
What do you find when you go out to these galleries? Give us some of the titles of the of some of the talks and the exhibitions and some of the concepts that you've encountered, and what do they mean for us?
I promise I didn't try to find this kind of art. I just said, okay, what are the premier galleries and institutes? I'm just going to go and see what I find. And every single one was about identity politics. So there was one piece of art called Ava 3.0, a stock 3D model used by companies that produce adult, like 3D adult entertainment and video games. And the artist had this model, you know, spraying female ejaculate at the viewer.
Ugh.
And that's it.
And this comes with a text that says, you know, this work examines the commensurate intricacies of intersectionality and sexual agenda.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, well, exactly.
A lot of our listeners aren't necessarily bathed in the identity politics world. So, I mean, just let's back up a second here and say, when you say identity politics, how do you define that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say it's politics that denies the possibility of the universal, right? Of some truths that can be held in common by all people by virtue of the fact that we're people.
Although it will never admit that, right? I mean, that's the major insight that you have in the book is that it denies the possibility of the universal while at the same time claiming that it, meaning just the art of those who feel themselves to be marginalized for one reason or another, is the only constant.
Yes.
Okay, have you seen any like art you liked recently? Or has it just all been things you didn't find artistically?
I'm going to sound really curmudgeonly, but yeah, I mean, I went to a performance of Rachmaninoff's All Night Vigil in London, and that was great, but that's, you know, about a century old.
So you're a real classicist, is what you're saying.
No, you know where I find real beauty? I find it in a lot of Hollywood movies, weirdly enough. So I think Christopher Nolan is a visual master, and there's more worthwhile imagery and real beauty in his movies than in any of the sort of serious, you know, this is a video installation at the Institute of Contemporary Arts London or at the MoMA or whatever. And because Hollywood is in some ways liberated from some of these kind of demands of the high art world.
Well, because it actually has to make money and is not supported by grants.
And there is an aspect of making money, and you still have to appeal to some part of people that where they enjoy beauty. And so I think Christopher Nolan's Interstellar is very beautiful.
Let me ask you a question that you yourself answer in the book, which I think is a really important one. What does any of this matter? I mean, you write about all these like art installations and exhibitions and some theater and, you know, probably what a couple thousand people see them. They're sponsored by grants and, you know, they exist within this very academic tenured radical community, right? What's the matter to the rest of us?
Well, I mean, at a basic public policy level, which I don't mention in the book, is that a lot of this is actually funded to the tune of, I mean, yes, they're grants, but these are enormous grants.
Sure.
I think, but that's a kind of a side point. I think the main point why this matters is that art historically, the very best art, to me, has helped people, as I said, to relate to each other and to resolve maybe differences that other kinds of societies resolve through civil war, through dictatorship, through ethnic cleansing, whatever. And so if the highest kind of art, the art that is the serious art that defines a culture, and it's the ones that governments and academia sponsor with our money, is all just constantly saying, division, division. You know, I can't relate to you because I have certain privileges, or you can't relate to me because you're privileged. And it just creates a, not only is the art ugly and inept, but it creates a coarse culture. These ideas, by the way, never stay in this academic realm. I think they always filter down. So I think a lot of people now, I see it in Facebook, their idea of what, you know, was this movie good? Is, did it affirm certain kind of political claims that I hold, or did it not?
So no, in a weird way,
correct.
And you make this point in the book that this sounds, although, you know, comes from two different terminologies and lexicons, but this sounds a lot like Donald Trump, right? It's the same kind of basic identity-driven competitive philistinism that we're seeing, you know, in the debate.
Yeah, so, I mean, in the book's conclusion, I do explicitly draw the connection, which is that if culture only rewards the assertion of identity, I am black, therefore XYZ, I am trans, therefore XYZ, then other people, I would call them the kind of silent majority, for lack of a better term, they're going to start wanting their piece of the identity pie. Well, what about me? And so I think part of this backlash of what's called the alternative right, that's really, really nasty and genuinely anti-Semitic, genuinely racist and sexist and misogynistic, is partly it's a mirror image of this kind of politics on the left. I fully kind of put my cards on the table. I'm not the only one to have noticed this, that sort of the outright and the very sort of extreme left identity politics they're caught up in this weird circuit where they feed into each other.
Hey, so you recently decided that Twitter was the right place to announce to the world that you're becoming a Catholic. I gather that you were raised Muslim, or you're ancestrally Muslim?
Yeah, Muslim born, Shiite born in Iran, because I was born and raised in Iran.
Okay, so
but my family, I mean, yeah, wasn't super practicing.
So, you know, you're not a committed Muslim. You're not super practicing. You have a spiritual urge inside you. You have a wealth of world religions to choose from. You could have become a Jew. We would have happily had you.
Yeah, I'm like a little offended you didn't.
Yeah, and you choose.
I feel like we were close. We were like maybe a close second.
You know, you're at the Wall Street Journal. There's some Jews there. You knew what was up. You sampled us. Don't deny it. And you all end up choosing Catholicism. Like, what's going on there? Is it like you believe the whole the resurrection thing? Do you believe it's true, or is this like those are your people culturally? How did it tell us about your journey?
To boil it down, I actually came to Catholicism from pretty much unbelief. It actually had been brewing for 10 years, you know, so I was raised in a kind of secular middle-class Iranian context. And for me, religion was just the Islamic Republic, which is this oppressive Islamist theocracy. So I tried Nietzsche, thought, you know, God is dead, it's obvious, without having really thought it through, and then just went through and for a while Marxism, psychoanalysis, Foucault and postmodernism, but I was never fully satisfied. And the dirty secret was that when I still felt like I had a kind of human need, or I was in moments of crisis, I would pray to an almighty and then set that aside and go back to being a staunch atheist and secularist. So the experience of brokenness, of my own brokenness and other people's, led me to think that, you know, the more ancient tradition, the Judeo-Christian tradition of seeing all of us as somehow that there's a brokenness written into us, made much more sense. And that if the claims of the New Testament, which I found both aesthetically beautiful because of that mind, if they're true, and this is a vision of the world that makes sense to me, that it takes the sacrifice of the Almighty himself to redeem the world, then where do you find kind of the fullest expression of it all? And so I went to Catholicism because of its authority, the beauty of the liturgy in the Mass, the fact that there's this kind of unbroken, nearly unbroken chain of authority from Christ down to the apostles, and then the kind of apostolic succession down to Pope Francis. So although I flirted for a while with evangelical Christianity, ultimately I found the fullest expression of this truth in the Catholic Church. So I took this step.
Hallelujah, brother.
I've noticed that a lot of Catholics, or a lot of converts, a lot of catechumens, have a friend or a priest, a particular person who kind of guided them in. Have you had such a person?
Yeah, I would say my catechist, very old-fashioned English, and he's a convert himself, although he converted when he was 12. So he's been very influential. And the interesting thing was that, you know, he seemed like he was suited for me, like he was created for me. So I decided to sort of become a Catholic. So I knocked on this, you know, this house where these priests leave, and I knocked on the door, and he opened, and he's like, well, what do you want? I said, I want to become a Roman Catholic. And he said, you know, he said, okay, I shall teach you.
You're
and
like the reverse Jehovah's Witness. You knock on the door to ask questions.
Wait, is this guy, yeah. This is a priest? This was like a priory or a monastery or something? Or?
Yeah. I won't go into the details because I'm Muslim born. I don't want to specifically identify where this church is.
But, oh, okay.
And why this setup exists. But basically, you know, he said, okay, I shall teach you. And then he just, without missing a beat, he said, we begin with Aristotle.
And, that's amazing.
And that's how it went. So it was intellectually, it was suited for my brain. So I wouldn't say it's providential, but it's very lucky that was my first encounter.
You know, I read this essay that you wrote about it, which is wonderful, by the way. And you know, everyone should Google it and read it. And I got to tell you, from the depth of my very, you know, hardcore Jewish soul, I agree with you. I think Christianity is arguably really the only civilizing force left in the world. And you know, more power to you.
I think what Liel is trying to say to our Gentile of the Week, Sourab Akhmari, author of The New Philistines, is Mazel Tov.
That's exactly right.
Sourab, thank you. Thanks for joining us as the Gentile of the Week.
I appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye. Upcoming live shows. I'm just going to talk about one. Many of you are downloading this on Thursday, October 27th. If you're in the Boston area or have friends who are, then you would want to know about our show at Hebrew College in Boston. The bill just gets better and better. Jeremy Hobson of NPR's Here and Now, retired General Tom Hill, and Boston Globe columnist Jeff Jacoby will all be there with us. November 17th, we'll be in Toronto. February 10th in West Palm Beach, Florida. Drop us a line if you're interested in booking us for a live show. We're not super affordable, but some of you have a lot of money, so you should drop us a line. If that interests you, email our Director of Audience Development and podcast producer, Alyssa Goldstein, at egoldstein@tabletmag.com. Oh, as a mug in boom, la-di-da-di. Oh, as a mug in bang, la-di-da-di. Our Jew of the Week he's really Jewy. Orthodox educated Noam Osband is a filmmaker, and he's finishing a degree in anthropology at the University of Pennsylvania. Speaking of Jewy, his first feature was the film, do you say Adelante?
Adelante, yeah.
Adelante, which profiled Mexican immigrants who were revitalizing an Irish Catholic church outside Philadelphia. His most recent film is a short called The Radical Jew, which is a profile of Baruch Marzel, who is a leader of the Israeli far right. It just won the best short documentary at the Tallgrass Film Fest and Charlotte Film Fest. Where's Tallgrass?
Wichita, Kansas.
You won best short in Wichita?
In Wichita, Kansas.
And he has the t-shirt to prove it. He's wearing it right now.
I was there, yeah.
Only the winner gets a shirt, by the way. There's one shirt.
So this guy, he's a Jew who's big in Wichita. So, hey, Noam, thank you for being our Jew of the Week.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So you wanted to start in, Liel, with the short on Baruch Marzel, right?
I mean, me and the people of Wichita. Okay. We both have respect for that kind of thing. I thought it was amazing. Tell us, first of all, about the movie. Who is this guy? How did you become interested in him? And what did you find out when you talked to him?
Sure. So Baruch Marzel, everybody knows who he is in Israel, and almost nobody knows who he is in America. He is one of the leaders of the far right in Israel. He's run for parliament a few times and has narrowly missed. His work could best be described, although this term is now so loaded, he's a community organizer. So he organizes lots of rallies and politics. He helps run the guest house. He lives in Hebron, which is the largest city in the West Bank. And it's also the only place where there's Jews living inside a Palestinian city. And what he's best known for is he's probably the foremost Kahanist in Israel. So he was Rabbi Meir Kahana's right-hand man. Meir Kahana was a far-right Jewish leader. He forms the Jewish Defense League in the late 1960s.
Assassinated this week. No, next week.
At the downtown
some
Hilton,
years ago,
right?
Downtown Marriott.
Marriott, sorry.
In the first ever Al-Qaeda attack on U.S. soil.
So Baruch Marzel was Kahana's right-hand man, and Kahana was in the parliament for a term until his party Kach was banned. To date, the only party in modern Israel whose ban has been upheld by the Supreme Court, accused of opposing democracy and inciting racism, and Marzel was his right-hand man.
How did you get him? Why choose him?
So Marzel is a distant relative. And Marzel,
Baruch Hashem.
So growing up, we knew it was like crazy cousin Baruch because he was this firebrand. I met him twice.
That makes the Seder so much funnier.
We all have a crazy cousin Baruch, but you actually have a crazy cousin.
Few of them were head of a group, though, that was declared a terrorist group by Israel and the United States, unlike this cousin. And so I met him once when we were 13, my family went to Hebron, Hebron in Hebrew, and he gave us a tour. He gives lots of tours of Hebron. And I once stayed, he like put me up in the caravan next to him when I was in yeshiva for a year after high school, but I didn't really know him. And then I had this idea of, I was always interested in him. I mean, to me, Jewish, I hate the word terrorism, but the group has been declared a terrorist.
A really bad ring to it. Terrorism.
Well, I think terrorism is not a good term because it can be used for sort of anything that we don't like. But the group that he was the head of...
It's like the way the other guy's religion is a cult.
100%. But the group he was in charge of, Kach, was banned not long after the Baruch Goldstein massacre in Hebron. So I'm interested in the idea of sort of like Jewish extremism because, you know, for the better part of two millennia, Jews were not generally violent extremists because we couldn't be. And now sort of like in the last 140 years, right, you sort of have these strains of real muscular Zionism, which sort of do see sort of force as a Jewish ideal, which undoubtedly Marzel and Kahana do. And so I thought that was really interesting. And I wanted to make a movie, and the movie is done completely in the style of Errol Morris. Specifically, he has this TV program that he did on Showtime called First Person. You can find it on YouTube. It's amazing. And it's all these profiles of a single individual done in sort of, Errol Morris has this distinct style called an interrotron, where he puts a teleprompter in front of the camera, so you're looking directly into the interviewer's face. The interviewer is not looking at you. And what Errol Morris does, which I like, is he doesn't pass judgment in his films. And while I have strong views about Marzel, the best compliment I ever get, which I got in Wichita, was from people who are like, I saw the film and it seemed to me very objective.
And he was terrified by it. Marzel was. I mean, there's a point in the film in which he says, this is a great scene. He's standing there in the kitchen cooking this cholent or something in this immense pot and saying, you're going to make me look like a pussycat. Like he's afraid of you humanizing him.
Yeah, exactly. Marzel's scared. I'm going to make him look like
you're
weak.
Like you're going to
defang like a little
kitty. Amazing, right? Yeah. I love that moment.
The Arabs are going to be like, that guy's not so harsh.
And look, he's cooking cholent.
And
could be afraid of a guy like cooking cholent.
So I built my own interrotron. I bought like one small teleprompter, found a guy in New Jersey who makes these teleprompters. He custom built me one, the nicest guy ever, the Tomter. And I brought it to Israel. I got Baruch's phone number. I met up with him in a hotel lobby in Jerusalem, told him what I wanted to do. To a degree that is like rare in my experience with film subjects, he really didn't care. Like he was not really for it or against it. The really only thing he cared about is that like he didn't want me to interfere with his schedule. And as long as I wasn't getting in the way, that was cool.
He had people to rouse. He had racial anger to incite.
I mean, he's busy. He is a super busy guy.
He is. And in the film, he shares with you his ideology in a way that comes off as very earnest. I've spent a lot of time with these guys, so I've heard this before, but I think you captured it very nicely. He says, look, I don't know why you're calling me a racist. I'm not a racist. I would be very happy if an Arab wanted to convert to Judaism, he could marry my daughter. Like, right. Did you buy that?
I think he believes it. I think he thinks he isn't racist. Where I guess I strongly disagree with him is he thinks we don't hate them because they're Arabs. We hate them because they're the enemy.
Right.
And I think in his mind, they're an implacable foe who there's sort of no possibility for coexistence.
You see, you're getting it wrong. This is not a race war. It's a religious war.
Right.
Whatever scares you
sure.
more.
Sure. I mean, he thinks that ideologically, there is no way in which these people will ever come to live in peace with him. And I, you know, like, respectfully disagree. I just think that ultimately that ideology is always malleable and that eventually there does the possibility of coexistence exist.
But the thing that the movie captures, I think, so neatly is, unlike Kahana, who is this very charismatic firebrand rabbi, there is something, and now that I know that you've used this Errol Morris technique, it makes a lot more sense to me, but there is something almost naive and childlike in his eyes. I mean, you see a kind of almost innocence there in Marzell.
So, yeah, he's not as charismatic or as well-spoken or as well-written as Kahana, who, like, Kahana, there's a reason he managed to be, like, the leader of groups in two different countries. He was an amazing speaker and writer. In some sense, part of me thought of Marzell, I mean, he was a troublemaker as a kid. And there's a part of me that thinks that, like, one aspect of what he's doing is just, like, it's mischievous. And he sort of enjoys being mischievous, but his mischievousness is done on a much deeper sort of scale.
There's some pretty high stakes to his mischief making.
Yeah. What was his response to the film? Has he seen it?
He has not seen the film. He does not use email.
Old school.
Old school. So, you know, what I wanted to make in a film was a film that he would not be unhappy with. I think he would be happy with all the movie except for the last couple minutes where I sort of think he's directly connected. Well, I think he's connected. Now, I don't think he's ordering any of the things that the acts of Jewish violence that have happened now. And there has been an increase in the last couple of years of Jewish violence against Palestinian civilians and property in Israel. But I think he's undoubtedly like an inspirational leader, and he helps play a role. He's a member of Lahava, which is a far right group that foments violence. And I bring that up at the end. I think except for the end of that film, I'd like to think he would be okay with it. And I mean, the funny thing about extremism, right, is like, so a big inspiration for the film was the documentary Jesus Camp. I don't know if any of you saw it.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Jesus Camp is a great documentary about this like Christian fundamentalist camp. I saw it and I was like, holy cow. Like, this is really crazy. The Village Voice reviewed
holy
it.
Holy red heifer.
Yeah, the Village Voice reviewed it and said like, this is a scary view of American fundamentalism. The people in Jesus Camp, on the whole, loved it. Yes. They said, yeah, this is who we
this
are.
This is like the time, I just have to tell the story. This is like the time when I wrote about a Mormon temple, which I was allowed to see as a journalist before they seal it and never again let in non-Mormons. I took a tour and I wrote that it had the aesthetic of a first-class businessman's hotel, which I thought was a bit of a put-down. They loved it. They were like, exactly. We always
what we were going
we
for.
Always want to look like a Marriott. They just loved, they thought, what a compliment.
Yeah. So Marzell is pretty much the only voice. There's a lot of archival footage of Kahana, but pretty much the only voice is Marzell, and he gets to say his piece. So I think most people hearing this person talk about, you know, sort of we want them out, and it's, you know, how we don't hate them because they're Arabs, we hate them because they're the enemy, would probably come away not thinking great of him. But I mean, it's funny because I had people tell me they were worried that either the film is going to make people think that a lot more Jews are like this in Israel than there are. But I also had people saying, what in my mind the greatest worry is that there's going to be like some kid in Brooklyn who sees this and thinks that sort of Kahana is the right way forward, which I don't think is the case. To answer your question, what was the most surprising thing? Easily, the thing that was most surprising to me, and I bring this up in the film, he's an adorable grandfather. Like, he is... I had very loving grandparents. My grandparents were like not nearly as affectionate with me as like he is with them. He's like really cute and laughing and cuddly.
Can I just say they always are like really scary fundamentalist people. Part of it is because they're building a movement and he looks at his grand. I'm just guessing. He looks at his grandchildren and thinks these guys are the future. Like the investment in when you're an ideologue, the investment in the next generation is super tremendous. Strong. Like you want to love. You don't want those kids to rebel.
I mean, I don't even think it's necessarily ideology as much as like peru or avu, you know, be fruitful and multiply. And it's like the most important thing a Jew can do is have a large Jewish family. And he has had, he says at one point, unfortunately, I've only had 9 kids, but that's what God gave us. That's a great detail.
7 of them were arrested by the police. Baruch Hashem.
Baruch Hashem. 7 out of the 9 have been arrested, he says. And he's a very nice person on the whole. If you're a Palestinian living in there, you wouldn't think that. But if you're Jewish, and especially if you're not a hardcore leftist, he's actually a very sweet person. I don't want to make him sound like
a
monster.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Now, you wrapped up shooting on Wednesday. On Thursday, you were somewhere completely different.
Yeah. So I have had a very lucky film experience in life because I have had my film career intrinsically connected to American game shows. So I started making films my first year of my PhD program. That summer, I said to myself, like, I want to buy my own gear. How am I going to do this? Da 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 da! I was a Jeopardy contestant and a one-time Jeopardy champion.
God bless America.
I bought my film gear.
Mazel tov.
I feel like truly lucky that this has happened to me. And then a few years later, I was in Israel working on this film, and I had tried out for Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And they told me, like, my date, I had to cut my trip short, and then I had to, like, rush the interview. I almost actually didn't get the interview. And then I shot the interview, like, went straight from there to the airport, landed, had, like, a few hours of sleep, and then taped an episode of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And
did well for yourself.
I did well for
How much?
Myself. I'm embarrassed. Like, I rarely talk.
You're going to make us go to Google? Dude, we will find the clip.
You'll find it. I did not post it online, but other people have.
Taxes, what is it?
I won $250,000.
Nice.
Was your phone a friend, Baruch Marzel?
They don't do phone a friend anymore because of Google.
Phone friend can sit there with the Google. Right?
That would have been amazing.
I should say, I am so self-conscious of talking about this with people.
And honestly, as the father of four, that doesn't even sound like a lot of money. That's like summer camp for two kids for one summer. Like, honestly, if you told me $250,000, I was like, great, one of my four children can go to college 9 years from now.
For like a little bit.
Hey, listen, you brought your ukulele with us. Will you do a song?
I will.
All right, awesome.
Well, multi-talented and great hair, I want to say.
Look at the curls.
I
the Samson-like.
Okay. I am embarrassed talking about game shows. By contrast, I am vain and aware of it about my hair.
Great hair.
Occasionally, I'll have people come up to me and like strangers and say, can I rub my hand through your hair? And like, I'm
so
not going to
lie.
I love
that,
it.
But you like it.
You like it.
Yeah, I think like if I...
You do not feel microaggressed that your Jufro is an object of Orientalism for them.
No, I love it. And it's complete like, complete gaiva, complete arrogance. And I love it. Okay, so this song is going to need a little audience participation. We're going to get to it, but you're going to have to sing the chorus with me. The chorus is perfectly adenine. So this is a song about racism. So we live in a crazy time,
aren't they
right?
All?
We live in a world where there's like a major party candidate in the U.S. who has said horrible things about Muslims and about Mexicans. And I think putting on my anthropology cap, part of the reason why these things don't strike us as so obviously insane as they are is because we're sort of inured to the fact that people talk about these groups. And we sort of categorize these as groups that it's okay to say not that it's okay to say crazy things about.
But they're the other.
We categorize these as groups that one does say crazy things about. So I have thought perhaps if we thought about these horrible ideas with a perfectly innocent group, we would realize how crazy racism is. And to that effect, I have written a song. And I'm going to sing the chorus. You're going to sing along. And then we're going to sing it. Poppies, 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 they ain't cuddly. Poppies, poppies, poppies taking over the world. Poppies, 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 they ain't cuddly. Poppies, poppies, poppies taking over the world. Poppies, they run Hollywood, they run Wall Street too. Who finances all the world's wars? We all know it's the poppies, 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 they ain't cuddly. Poppies, poppies, poppies taking over the world. On some holy holidays, you know what some people do? Who makes a cracker out of Christian blood? We all know it's those poppies, 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 they ain't cuddly. Poppies, poppies, poppies taking over the world. If you think Bin Laden was a plotting, I've got news for you. Who wasn't there when the towers fell? We all know it's those poppies, 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 they ain't cuddly. Poppies, poppies, poppies taking over the world. Goldilocks is a fairy tale, Auschwitz is one too. Who profits off the Holocaust? We all know it's those poppies, 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 they ain't cuddly. Poppies, poppies, poppies taking over the world.
Yeah.
Poppies.
Wow. Noam,
that was something.
Osband, thank you so much for being our Jew of the Week.
Thank you for having me.
More at noamosband.com.
Yeah.
You got the com.
I'm not a nonprofit, it'll be .org, but until then.
I have decided to set to song Donald Trump from November 12th, 2015, talking about Ben Carson. These are exactly his words, edited for brevity. I have not made anything up. When he says he's pathological, and he says that in the book, I don't say that.
And again, I'm not saying anything. I'm not saying anything other than pathological's a very serious disease.
All right. Mazel Tovs of the week, Stephanie.
Ooh, I got one. It's for Tablet's own Yair Rosenberg, who, according to an ADL report released recently, is the Jewish journalist second most harassed by neo-Nazis on Twitter.
Mazel Tovs, Yair. Yeah, that's
next
good work.
Next year, he'll be number one on that list.
My Mazel Tov is to the terrific orthopedic ER specialist who talked me through. So the question was, are we going to just do that thing where they wrench your finger into alignment before they splint it? Or are they going to give you like some pain meds and then you won't know and whatever? And I said, you know, make it like that scene in Say Anything where John Cusack's punched in the nose and the trainer comes over and just does that awful crunching sound to put his nose. Like, I'm going all in. And he did. And it was gentle and sweet. And I'm on the mend. So to that doctor whose name I forget in the ER in New Haven, Mazel Tov, you are on your way, man. Liel, top that.
I will. My Mazel Tov is to my rabbi, my mentor, my light unto the nations, Leonard Cohen, at 82, releases a new album this week. You know, I've written a book about him. I will review the album to the extent that one can next week on Tablet. But I got to tell you, this is a masterpiece. It is profound. It is truly a manual for living with defeat. And let's go out with some notes.
See your way through the ruins of the altar and the mall. See your way through the fables of creation and the fall. See your way past the palaces that rise above the rock. Year by year, month by month, day by day, thought by thought.
Unorthodox is brought to you by Tablet Magazine. It's edited this week by Noah Levinson and produced by Alyssa Goldstein and Shira Talushkin. Rabbinic supervision is by Fox News anchor and presidential debate host Chris Wallace, who is indeed a Jew, despite being named Chris and Wallace. Kosher Slaughtering is by Kellyanne Conway. I think she's gotten it before, but she's got to get it again. Her post-debate spin room meltdown was just a thing of beauty. Follow Tablet on Facebook and on Twitter, at Tablet Mag. Our music is by Golem. We record at the penthouse known as Argo Studios in New York City. Shalom, friends.